All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the second semifinal session of the 2011 Student Speaker Challenge. I'm just going to ask that everyone please turn off their cell phones before we get started so that there's no interruptions during our speakers' presentations. And I'll just wait a few seconds for everyone to get seated. All right, so to get started, the 2011 Student Speaker Challenge is presented in partnership by the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, by the Lethbridge Public Interest Research Group, the University of Lethbridge, and the University of Lethbridge Students Union. My name is Vanessa Lodemeyer, and I'm a fifth-year student here at the U of L, and I have a general major in the social sciences, and I will be your moderator for today's session. Our presenters today will be addressing the question, what is global justice and how can it be achieved? Both presenters will have 15 minutes to present their respective responses to the question, and an additional 15 minutes will be allotted to each presenter following their presentation to answer questions from a panel of judges as well as from the audience. Following the conclusion of both presentations and question periods, our judges will hand in their scorecards, at which point the winner of today's session will be announced. The winner will move on to the final round of the 2011 Student Speaker Challenge, which takes place next week. At every Student Speaker Challenge session, the panel of judges consists of one student, one faculty member, and one community member. The student judge for this session is Keith Gardner, editor-in-chief at the Muirist. The faculty judge for this session is Deb Jarvie, who teaches courses in the management faculty, and our community judge is Bev O. That's right. And your community involvement is? All right. Thank you very much. We're expecting a very riveting contest today between Rory Tarrant and Channing Stenhouse. Rory Tarrant served two terms as president of the Grand Prairie Regional College Students Association and previously worked for the Member of Parliament for Peace River. Recently, Rory ran for Lethbridge City Council Alderman. Channing Stenhouse is a socially conscientious fifth-year music major who intends on pursuing graduate studies after completing her education here. It is time to begin. By virtue of a coin toss, it has been decided that Channing will speak first. Please welcome Channing.
Can everybody hear me all right? Great. So what is global justice and how can it be achieved? What a daunting question. What is global justice? Is it a universal right to education? Is it a universal equality? Can it be dealt by a judicial court based on legal criteria? Is it our current system? Does justice even have to be fair? What is fair? What is global justice? I can't tell you what global justice is. I can't tell you what global justice is because I do not know what global justice is. But what I do know is that life is not fair. All men and women are not created equal. We are not created equal in that we are not the same. We live in different places and are raised with different beliefs. We have different aspirations and abilities, and we will never be the same. I know that some will always be smarter than others. Some will always be better looking than others. Our Canadian injustice, some will always be warmer than others. Some will have more, and some will have less. And some will need more, and some will need less. I know that these differences are bound to lead to a multiplicity of life's realities. Inequality will always exist between people. What I do know is that life is not fair, but that things can be better. In the developed Western world, we tend to share a common belief that a functional democracy brings about the greatest good for the greatest number. Our own Canadian political system is that of a democracy. All Canadians have a right to vote, and all votes are counted equal. By participating in this process, Canadians vote for what they believe will bring about the greatest good. You can vote either based on what will bring about the greatest good for yourself, or you can vote based on what you think will bring about the greatest good for all. But the underlying principle is that at the end of the day, when the votes are tallied, the greatest good will come about for the greatest number of people, or in our case, the greatest number of Canadians. But it stops there. And it is our representatives' duty to act in our best interests, the best interests of Canadians. But we are not an island. We Canadians number almost 34 million, but there exist roughly 6,800,000,000 other people on Earth. And this last part is the key. On Earth. Now, it's not revolutionary to consider the world as a whole. In 1945, we had 51 nations form the UN. And the UN today acts as an international forum, mediating disputes, promoting peace and democracy, supplying aid to countries in need, and in some cases, even eradicating disease. What we need, though, perhaps more than an international institute of moderation, is global governance. No more can we act as though the problems over on the other side of the world are not ours. We often hear talks of the effects of globalization. Now, globalization is described as a process through which regions become more interdependent. The mainstream media lends a lot of time to the economic discussion of globalization. Crop failures in A increases food prices in B, and threatens C security, which brings D's currency to a plummet. With trade relations being perhaps the hottest topic on the agenda of almost all nations' leaders, globalization is increasingly important. But who is it that reaps the benefit of this globalization? Does the wealth of a nation increase drastically from economic specialization in trade? Does GDP go up? And if GDP goes up, does social well-being increase? Those making the most gains in our current system of globalization are corporations. It is the corporations who make money off the backs of nations. And nations, I will argue, are almost powerless in their struggle with these multinationals. Taxes could be collected in order to share the wealth among the people. But when the taxes are imposed, the corporations pull its business and relocate to an area with cheaper labor and supplies, rendering the First Nation jobless and destroying national economies, destroying families. It is with this attitude that we see a constant changing of the corporate map. No longer are our shoes made in Mexico or our light bulbs manufactured in the USA. Instead, the labor has relocated to a sweatshop in Taiwan. Nations do not benefit from this system. The people do not benefit from this system. What we need to do to rein in this corporate free-for-all is to stop corporations from being able to simply relocate their problems. This must be done by allowing a global governing body to act on the behalf of all citizens, citizens of the world. A global governing body would be able to say yes to labor unions. A global governing body would be able to say no to relocation. A global governing body could put an end to the seemingly insatiable thirst of corporations and at long last impose a system of tax collection that would be for the benefit of the people. A global governing body, though, at this point, would have many obstacles to overcome. Our current world order is largely dependent on the nation-state. A nation-state is a sovereign entity and many would oppose adhering to a global government. Many others, if we look to the model provided us by the UN, would worry about the trickle-down effect. Nations' leaders are not all democratically elected. Now, what I propose to fix this and lessen confrontation with sovereign nationals is a global democracy in which every nation must hold a free election, not to elect their national representatives, but to elect their representative on this new global government. Imagine this to be much like our regional, federal, and provincial government that we have here in Canada. Each level of government has a separate set of responsibilities and capabilities. Each level has a separate set of elections where the people of a particular constituency each have the right to vote. And each level of government works together to provide the greatest good for the greatest number of Canadians. What I propose is that we use our current system of nation states to create a larger separate government body that can help to create the most good for the largest number of people. Rather than having a nation's representative be appointed by the leader of that country, who may have come to power by peaceful or other means, each representative would be elected by the people. This does not force regime changes on any one nation, but instead ensures that the people are truly being represented at some layer of government. Now, this representative could then work with the national government of particular countries and help to reallocate resources that truly do belong to these people. Now, according to the New York Times, this past year, American businesses earned profits at an annual rate of $1.65 trillion profit. I understand that in order to maintain development and growth, that companies must earn a profit so that they can reinvest and keep our economies alive. But at this point, rather than reinvesting profits, companies are holding on to their cash while continually giving large bonuses to a business elite at the top. Millions of workers have lost jobs because companies have cut production in order to deal with a global decline in demand. Meanwhile, there has been a global decline in demand as workers are laid off and wages remain stagnant. Some workers have been asked not only to work longer hours, but also to accept less pay for their work in order to keep their jobs. And with employment scarce, and corporations again willing to relocate for cheaper resources and cheaper labor, the laborer is forced to either accept or starve. This outrageous economic model, whereby human efforts sell for mere pennies, can be stopped if we unite in a global effort. A global government could be given the ability to enforce labor laws. A global government could be given the ability to enforce environmental policies and to help establish a true purchase power parity, making the labor of every color and creed of man equal. A global government could impose a flat tax rate on corporations that would not infringe upon a nation's ability to attract business, as it would be static everywhere. This new source of revenue could eradicate disease, fund education, eliminate hunger, and even help create jobs. Things can be better as a whole. We need to start looking at the planet not as a collage of pictures, but a single canvas nation of one people. One people, one planet. And we only get one shot. So what do we do? While my words now will sound more like the echo of a crowd somewhere in Tunisia or Egypt or Wisconsin or Libya, we must take action. We, especially here in Canada, with all of our freedom and opportunity, must elect leaders who represent our needs rather than cater to the business elite. Corporate tax exemptions must stop. We must not stand for the disembowelment of our labor unions. We need government creation or UN reform, however you'd like to put it, but we need to continue our consideration beyond our borders. It is time for change. It is time for government of the people, of all the people. It is time for justice to take on meaning beyond that of international business mediation. It's time for a global government by the people, for the people of the world. I'd like to conclude then with a call to action. Well, bear with me for a moment. I'd like to address you, the academic community, about an issue I feel is impeding our ability to inspire this change. I often hear many of my colleagues complain that we Westerners are apathetic. I do not believe people to be of an apathetic nature. The people here in Canada, in North America, don't not care. They don't know. And the people don't know because we don't take the time or make the effort to tell them. It is our responsibility as academics to inform the people so that they may make informed decisions. But so often, when we do make the attempt, we use unnecessary jargon. Sometimes we're kind of dry. There's an extreme disconnect between academia and the public. They don't trust us because we don't take the time to explain ourselves in layman's words. The people are capable of understanding. It is we who don't speak the vernacular. Now, Thomas will speak next week about teaching the holistic, and I really like this idea. But I say we don't even have to go that far. We simply need to tell the truth. We need to stop teaching the dogma that equivocates free markets with democracy. So my call then to you is to speak to the people. Make your voices heard and share the knowledge that you've gained here. You're the experts. We've all shown persistence in our studies. Now let us show that that persistence carries beyond and into our lives. Make your voices heard. Speak eloquently, but with passion. And let none who will listen to you evade you. Help make the change that we need. Inspire that change. Be that change. Thank you.
Thank you, Channing. We will now have 15 minutes for our question period. We will give priority to our judges to ask their questions first, and then we can open up the floor to the rest of the audience, and I'll just help moderate for Channing.
I agree 100%.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering why you chose Canada's particular system when you know that there are so many problems in it and you kind of lost the willingness to work. And what do you think is the pristine state?
Okay. Why I chose Canada is because I'm speaking to a group of Canadians, and although I do admit that there are huge problems with our Canadian government system, I would personally prefer to model ourselves on something more like Sweden, or even Switzerland for that matter. But that said, I chose a Canadian, like the Canadian metaphor just for the Canadian audience, and to get the concept of varying layers of government across. And that democracy will never be perfect. There will always be somebody who's not satisfied with the end product. Perhaps, you know, even in Canada, a system of representation by population might be a little bit more appropriate. But it's still it is still somewhat functional. And I think that's why I used it. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
Today's
very actually going to say, even the best democratic system, women are underrepresented. How would you seek to encourage an equal representation of women in this global government, especially to
Well, it is all going to come down to a democracy. We should be allowing women or providing services for them, such as a daycare, a better education system. I personally believe that education should be publicly funded, and that would alleviate a lot of the stress that women often find when they're trying to seek education. Daycare should be provided, and I think that if these things were to be provided, we would find a lot more women in the workforce and in politics.
Can I just ask? So for you, then, it's a social response, not necessarily a governmental response. It's a social response. You have to create the social programs, not necessarily enforce something like the gender for them.
I've never actually considered the concept of a gender quota, but it would be interesting. Do we have any examples of that?
There are some out there. I know WADA does have a gender quota subscription. In fact, more than half the members of the legislature of WADA are female. Other electoral systems I know do are more conducive to female representation in Congress. So there are a number of institutional responses you can take.
Okay. Well, I do think that we should be providing social services that would enable women to make that choice, and I'm kind of more on the choice side than anything else. Yes.
Chad, I was just wondering, you mentioned a lot about corporations.
Do you mean, like, should we force people to rely on their generosity? Well, I do think that this system doesn't argue that we need to get rid of corporations, although I might personally argue something more along those lines. But I don't think that this would force the elimination of the corporation, but it would force them to no longer be able to just relocate their problems. As it seems to me that, you know, oftentimes, you know, Mexico wants to raise labor standards, and they'll just march off somewhere else, we'll find cheaper labor. And when people are hungry, or when we're imposing a system, a new economic model on them that forces them to go hungry as opposed to their traditional ways, then they are going to accept the terms of these corporations. And I think that a global governance with a global tax base that wouldn't allow them to just move around would allow for corporations to continue to exist and just have to be forced to be socially responsible. Like redefining wealth as opposed to just being looking at GDPs and such like that? Absolutely, absolutely. We need to redefine the concept of wealth to include things like social well-being, what sort of social programs are available, what is the education, like what's the availability for education in areas, what is the medical system available in areas. We can't just look at wealth as though it's just a number. It has to be the real living thing. Like the concept of living wealth, I think, would be something more that I would want to look into rather than just justifying wealth on a numerical basis. And I don't think that corporations are capable of supplying us with this greater wealth.
Are there any other questions beyond me? Yeah.
What do you want to do with our they're there, and they're fully operational, and the United Nations is not all of itself, you know, the video and things like that. And so, what do you think about that? It's going to be, you know, the new system, the greater time, I really appreciate it, but what do you think about the individuals? Because
What I was imagining more is if something like this were to be put into place, we would have regional leaders that would be elected by the people. Like this new layer of government does not aim to oust any current layer of government through any real, like this would not undermine a current of government because it doesn't take over any of their resources. It doesn't it doesn't disable them to attract business. And I think that if we have this new revenue coming in, this new tax base that is, you know, just a flat rate on corporations all across because they can't just up and relocate, this is the only planet we're on so far, then I think that we'd be in a better position to encourage these dictators to step down because, you know, their people are being empowered, they're seeing, like if these regional representatives would provide educational facilities, educational opportunities for the people in there, the people will make sure that these things do change. There's a lot to be said for people power, and I think that we're seeing that across the world right now. It's actually, I think, probably, you know, quite a hopeful place at this point. And is there anything that I, in particular, have planned how to oust these dictators? No, unfortunately not. But I do think that this system would power the people to be much better able to do that. I think it would be one of the ways in which we could start, you know, performing our own little Robin Hood and taking from the rich and giving back to the poor.
I think that's a problem idea, but the problem is that corporations don't want to agree to that. So we're going to have to get our leaders to enforce that. And unfortunately, in the past several decades, and a lot of government leaders are actually corporately involved, and it doesn't seem to be something realistic in that sense that the leaders are going to say, oh yeah, let's tax corporations and form more government.
And are the leaders that we have in place right now, Without going into them, I have called for in the speech that we do need to start electing leaders that truly represent the needs of the people, and that we need to stop these corporate tax exemptions. It's our job at this point. I mean, we're the educated people. We are the experts. And I'm not going to say that, you know, there are not plenty of people who don't understand they do understand. The people are capable of understanding, and most of them do understand what's going on. But they're also being preached the dogma that democracy is equivocated with a free market enterprise. And what the people need to realize is that a democracy cannot function unless the people are granted some sort of money. So I think that's where this last call to action for us, those of us who are in this room, I think that's where it comes into play. Because yes, this is not going to happen overnight, but I think that if we did start educating these people, if we do speak eloquently and with passion, we will be able to move them to see what is best for themselves. Absolutely. If we do not take an active role in a new democracy, even in our own national democracies, if we do not take an active participatory role in democracy, this sort of thing will happen. Like it could continue to happen over and over and over again. But at this point, I think we're starting to see that democracy is much more than just casting a ballot. Should voting be mandatory? Perhaps it should. And I think maybe if voting were mandatory and there were still a way to spoil your ballot, because I do believe people should be able to remain apolitical if they want to be, but if voting were mandatory, I think they would find it a lot harder to overtake us with this corporate-backed crony government.
Any other questions? We have time for about one or two more. Pat.
Thank you, Jenny.
I'm a musician, so.
That is the problem. You speak beautifully, you speak idealistically, but people don't listen. And you said that academics don't speak the language, that may be true. But isn't another problem that they don't care? How do we do that?
Okay, I wish I had taken down the names of the studies that I have read, watched about, that actually show that people are designed for empathy, and that we have, over the years, we have grown to encompass more and more of the world. We see, you know, it used to be that we were tribal, and that we would see the people of our tribe as, you know, our blood kin. Then eventually we expanded that to religion, and then we extended that to national borders. This capacity for empathy that you do feel so very much in music, I think that we can truly extend this over across the world. And I would tell you that in the fact that, you know, when I watch the news, I often cry. I don't know any of these people, but I still can feel something for them. I refuse to believe. We don't have any hope if the people are truly apathetic. They are capable of understanding, and they do care. We just have to make them aware of everything.
Excuse me. In other words, you're saying that our language should include appeal to emotions.
Yes. Yes, it should. If we believe it in what it is that we are studying, we should stand behind it with conviction. So yes, we should.
All right, we'll just be taking a quick 5-minute break, and we'll come back with your second speaker. Thanks. All right, everyone. We'll be getting started in just a minute again, but I'd just like to make one short announcement. The Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs will be holding a talk called Alberta's Looming Water Market. Is public consultation necessary? And that will be held on Thursday, March 10th from 12 to 1:30 p.m. and that's at the Country Kitchen Catering on the lower level of the Cave. All right, and so if everyone can take their seats again, we will get started. Just give everyone a second, Marie. So Rory will now have 15 minutes to present his thesis. Let's welcome Rory, everyone.
Thank you. Greetings, fellow students, professors, members of the community, and our honored judges. I take great pleasure in standing before you today to address the topic of global justice. I will begin my speech today with a question that I would like each person here to take a moment to reflect on. The question is this. After years of sponsoring children through World Vision, buying goats through Oxfam, shipping wheat to Africa, and buying fair trade coffee, is the world any more just? If your experiences and knowledge align with my own, it is hard to make the case that our globe is a beacon of justice for the universe to behold. But what is global justice? Before addressing some of the practical ways in which the concept can be realized, I will share with you how I believe the term global justice should be defined and interpreted. Using these definitions and interpretations as a platform, I will then proceed by laying out several proposals for how global justice can be achieved. So what is global justice? Global justice is often defined through the notion of equality of condition. The basis for this notion is that every human being should be entitled to enjoy the same quality of life under the same conditions across the globe. Proponents of this view would have the state and international actors work together to create a system whereby assistance is given by the rich nations to the developing world in order to give the world's poorest a taste of the modern lifestyles we enjoy in the developed world. Notice my emphasis on a taste. Indeed, this view of global justice has dominated international development thinking for much of the post-World War II era. While the proponents of this ideology are typically very compassionate and inexplicably sensitive to the plight of the world's poorest, I believe this ideology and the actions that flow from it have in fact been counterproductive. After over 60 years of having states and NGOs provide direct financial support, technical assistance, food programs, and Medicare to address many of the world's injustices, very little progress has been made. I do not need to inundate you with the countless statistics relating to the numerous injustices that still occur today. From rampant starvation to curable diseases to the oppression of women to human trafficking, the world is very much as broken of a place today as it was decades ago. I believe a new mindset needs to take hold to reverse this trend. I propose that the world needs to more widely interpret global justice in terms of equality of opportunity. Instead of trying to guarantee that the same conditions are present in every nation, we need to allow the world's poorest countries to grow in the same way that developed countries have. I believe this can only be achieved if all nations and their citizens have the same opportunities that modern developed countries have. Studies have shown us that time and time again, when nations obtain these same opportunities, indicators such as economic wealth, social justice, and democratization have converged towards the global mean. This is aptly known as the convergence theory. Thus, it's within this concept that I believe global justice should be viewed. Moving away from the theoretical platitudes, I will now launch into the how of the topic. Equality of opportunity and the convergence theory sound great in concept, but they will remain just that, concepts, unless it is explained how these can be achieved and what benefits they will have. Two of the greatest factors in achieving equality of opportunity are political and economic freedoms. While each of these components has been crucial in the development of the modern world, I will contend today that it is by having economic freedoms that nations have the greatest propensity to combat global injustices. So what is economic freedom? Economists James Bortney and Robert Lawson explain that individuals have economic freedom when property they acquire without the use of force, fraud, or theft is protected from physical invasion by others, and they are free to use, exchange, or give their property as long as their actions do not violate the identical rights of others. Thus, when people are confident that the fruits of their labors cannot be taken away arbitrarily or by force, citizens everywhere have greater assurance that their labors will lead to better lives for themselves and their families. This enhances the entrepreneurial spirit, which causes people to take risks, which in turn creates a wealth generation cycle. Conversely, a government that does not enforce contracts, takes property from its citizens without due compensation, puts limits on voluntary transactions, violates the tenets of economic freedom. In so doing, such a government provides a disincentive for entrepreneurship and productivity, as individuals become skeptical about realizing the gains of their productive efforts. I would like to highlight this concept by contrasting a friend's experience in a country with high economic freedom with what he would have experienced in a nation with low economic freedom. My friend Paul decided to start working for a residential siding business a few years ago. He was not forced to take a certain type of schooling and then obtain employment in his assigned field. He was free to choose. After a couple of years of working, he had saved a significant amount of money thanks to fairly low income taxes and a banking system that allowed him to invest where he wanted to in the way he thought best. He then took this money and started his own siding business. Other than an inexpensive business permit, which is fairly easy to obtain, he did not have to go through a time-intensive bureaucratic slog in order to perhaps have the chance of owning his own business. Recently, Paul used the profits of his company to build a house, which he then sold for a greater return on the investment. I tell you this story to highlight how Paul has entered into a wealth generation cycle due to the economic freedom that was afforded to him. By the way, he did this all before he turned 23 years old. I will now contrast Paul's story with that of Mohamed Bouazizi. Mohamed was a 26-year-old man living in Tunisia. Now, Tunisia, for those who aren't aware, was run by a repressive dictatorship that afforded very few economic freedoms to its citizens. This came to the world's attention in December of last year, when Mohamed was charged with operating a fruit stand without a license. In reality, he had tried to obtain the proper license, and after months of bureaucratic wrangling, he just set up shop regardless. And after being charged, Mohamed lit himself on fire, and in so doing, he became a catalyst for the movement that would eventually oust the repressive president. While this is one isolated incident, it is symptomatic of the problems associated with a state undermining the economic freedoms of its population. Due to the subversion of a number of economic freedoms, mostly due to corruption, Tunisia's economy is in disarray, with youth unemployment sitting at a staggering 31%. Economic reform is essential for a reversal of this trend. Now, up to this point, I've highlighted how microeconomic policies shape the degree to which economic freedom is found within a nation, and how these freedoms contribute to wealth generation. I will now explain what economic freedom means at the macroeconomic level. The key to macroeconomic freedom is free trade. Now, to many people, the terms free trade or trade liberalization instantly bring up negative images of Nike sweatshops in Malaysia. Many see it as just another way in which the developed world exploits the developing world. I would like you to think beyond these images as I explain the full range of benefits the entire world derives from freer trade. However, before we examine the benefits of freer trade, I will begin by describing the pitfalls of free trade's foil, protectionism. Many nations believe that by protecting their domestic markets through price controls, market guarantees, and supply management, they're ensuring that their citizens have access to high-quality jobs, as well as to products at affordable prices. While these may be short-term benefits, in the long run, protectionist measures stifle productivity, cause domestic prices to rise, and prohibit other nations from accessing world markets freely, thus hindering economic growth. This is most often observed in agricultural markets, where developed countries give their producers large subsidies and protection from international markets. For example, it is illegal for sugar buyers in the United States to purchase their sugar from sources outside the country, even though the world price of sugar is much cheaper. This is great for U.S. sugar beet producers, as it means they would have a guaranteed supply of buyers at a price that is being kept artificially high by federal laws. If the United States were to abandon such self-centered policies, sugar growers everywhere would have access to their markets, thus contributing to economic growth elsewhere, and it would lower the price of sugar for everyone. Another component of trade policy is what is known as fair trade. While it may ease our consciences in the developed world, knowing that we are giving coffee producers in Bolivia a premium for their product, it is in fact detrimental because fair trade creates a false economy. It does this by giving farmers incentives to continue producing agricultural products, albeit for a slightly higher profit margin. However, this creates a disincentive for people and governments to diversify their economies, a key component in economic growth. The same can be said of aid programs that provide cows or chickens to help people start small farming operations. While there are honest and good intentions behind these programs, they, in effect, stifle entrepreneurial spirit by having foreigners dictate what these countries' economies should look like. These types of programs act in the same capacity as protectionist trade measures do, by subverting the economic freedom of the world's population. I've now given you the theoretical basis, as well as anecdotal evidence, for how economic freedoms support economic growth. I will now provide some empirical evidence which will highlight the strong positive correlation between the two. It is now well documented that a nation's degree of economic freedom is the single most important determinant in their rate of growth. In fact, the countries with the highest degree of economic freedom have an average annual growth rate per capita of real GDP of 2.4%, while those with the lowest degrees of economic freedom have an average of negative 1.3%. Thus, the degree to which a country exhibits economic freedom is the best predictor of a nation's per capita rate of growth. Now, the keen mind will notice that up to this point, it has been assumed that positive growth rate actually leads to injustices such as poverty being reduced. However, we must prove the validity of this argument, for if no correlation exists between the two, what I've said to this point is moot. Fortunately for me, the correlation has been well established, and it is to this correlation I will now turn. To reiterate, the greatest factor in the reduction of world poverty is the economic growth of nations. Theoretically, the linkage is self-evident. As individuals and nations increase their relative wealth, per capita income increases, which in turn allows basic life necessities such as food, clean water, and health, basic health care to be purchased, and thus the poverty cycle begins to break down. In practice, this linkage proves to be true across the globe. But let's not just take my word for it, let's look at the evidence. Two countries that have exhibited this trend are Peru and Chile. Both these countries extensively restructured their economies in the 1990s to provide for greater economic freedom. This in turn produced considerably high rates of economic growth. As a result, the past decade has seen poverty rates drop dramatically. In 1990, Peru had 19% of its population earning less than a dollar a day. By 2004, that number had dropped to 7%. Chile's reforms have caused their dollar per day poverty rate to drop to 2%. In addition to income growth, other poverty measures such as the infant mortality rate and life expectancy have improved immeasurably. So where does this leave us? Let's recap. If global justice is to be viewed through the lenses of equality of opportunity, then economic freedoms are essential. Economic freedoms lead to economic growth, which in turn leads to higher incomes and the reduction of extreme poverty. Now, before you hammer me with your objections, I'd like to throw a few caveats out there. I'm not so deluded to think that through the provision of economic freedoms alone, the world's problems will magically disappear. As I mentioned at the beginning, political freedoms are also crucial factors in achieving equality of opportunity. In addition, there are a number of traps that nations can be stuck in that neutralize any effects in addition, there are a number of traps that nations can be stuck in that may neutralize any effects political and economic freedoms have on a given populace. Paul Collier, in his book, The Bottom Billion, concisely identifies a number of these traps, such as being landlocked with bad neighbors or being over-reliant on natural resource revenues, particularly oil. Until countries can break out of these traps, economic and political freedoms will only marginally pull them out of poverty cycles. Finally, my last caveat is that I am not propagating a completely unrestrained, laissez-faire type of global capitalism. There will always be a need for governments to ensure that everyone is playing by the same rules and that the marketplace is indeed free and open to all those who wish to participate. With these caveats in place, I would like to conclude by providing a summary of the arguments I have made today. First, it is evident that current perceptions of global justice have brought us no further in our quest to eliminate the injustices of the world. Thus, a new mindset based on equality of opportunity should be adopted. Second, global justice, as seen through this mindset, will be realized chiefly through the expansion of economic freedoms across the world. These include microeconomic freedoms, such as the ability to start your own business, but it also includes macroeconomic freedoms, such as trade liberalization and the ending of fair trade practices. Together, these freedoms will reduce many of the world's injustices. Thus, it is our duty as global citizens to facilitate these changes facilitate the changes necessary to bring these freedoms to every human being. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Rory. We will now have another 15 minutes for questions. Again, we'll give our judges a chance to ask their questions first, and then we'll open it up to the audience for questions as well.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
the Adam Smith model, the global framework about taking care of the world. And I just wondering, have you considered how you could graduate things like the tragedy of commons, and that people, the tragedy of commons, they would know that they're doing their
own.
People out for their own good, and that they inherently, some people here have questions of their own beliefs about the consideration of the people around them, which is what seeing it as a downfall to a model.
I strongly believe people are motivated to increase their wealth. Every person sort of has this inherent within them, they want to better themselves. And I believe that, you know, in this pursuit of bettering themselves, they can benefit others. That's the essence of capitalism, is that, by looking for opportunities to increase wealth, to generate wealth, to provide for more, you can benefit yourselves, which in turn benefits others, through providing jobs, providing labor, or through direct, transfers to people, supporting people in different ways. So I strongly believe that that can actually be a motivating factor in eliminating these injustices. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I will address the same question I asked Kim earlier. How would you define wealth? And do you think that our current stagnation of wealth is impeding
No, not at all. I think it's great to look at wealth in other ways, but when you boil it down, if you want to talk about healthcare or talk about these different sort of living wealth, it boils down to money. These things cost money. To deliver healthcare, basic healthcare to the world, to provide food, to people. It all boils down to money, and so by generating wealth in terms of real physical assets and money and capital, those are going to, in effect, help alleviate some of the injustices.
Okay. You mentioned earlier on in your talk that economic freedoms were the reason why the Western world was able to develop like it did. Weren't slavery, sexism, and pretty egregious class oppression also part of that equation?
Definitely, and that's where governments need to step in and regulate to make sure that people, that rights are protected. And I don't believe that. I believe we would have developed in the same way without those types of things, without slavery. Britain was still a prosperous nation after they abolished the slave trade, and I don't.
They also had colonies overseas, which were mercantilist, oppressed places within
Well, that's another perception. A lot of, there's been a lot of scholars that have argued that they weren't necessarily oppressed peoples. A lot of these colonies, they were actually, their lives were improved immeasurably by the British, coming and creating this mercantilism system. And so, I think that's a matter of perception there.
Your premise that things are just as bad now in the world as they were at some point in this time, prior to being shipments and NGOs and child sponsorship and all these different things, I have to say, with one, I'd like to know what two time frames are you comparing? And when you're doing these comparisons, it seems to me that you've made a giant leap from the development of a model of the, say, Generation 1 development from Western countries to poorer countries, for those countries. And you miss out on what's been happening more recently. So that whole seems to me that you set up a big target and then shot it out.
And where?
Where did you get that out? It says there.
Well, first of all, the time frame I'm looking at is when we've started to really actively create a system of international development, which developed after the post-World War II era. So I'm looking in the past 60 years or so. I'm not claiming that it's worse. I'm claiming that there's the same injustices are occurring back then as they did now, and we have not progressed exponentially. When you look at the amount of aid money that has been given, you would expect enormous massive changes in terms of the rates of poverty in many of these third world countries, and we just haven't seen there has been success stories, and there has been certain places where their poverty rates have dropped, and there are on their way to becoming developed countries. But as a whole, when you look at the whole world, we have not changed immeasurably much in the past 60 years. Well, it's difficult to say, when you're looking at exact numbers, right? I mean, you could look at, there's a number of, per capita, incomes haven't changed, have changed very little, so that there is, some empirical things we can look at. But when you start looking at, suffering of women, right, it's really hard to put an empirical number on it. Do we count, how many people were oppressed, how many women were oppressed back then, to how many are oppressed right now, the degree to which they were oppressed. And so because, it's really hard to empirically, there's a number of those measures that are hard to empirically measure, we have to look, at perceptions and hearing the stories from people that come back from these countries, in the documentaries that are put out. And it's, in my opinion, I guess it is my opinion, the perception, has not changed measurably. Thank you.
Pat?
How do you explain China, the world most repressed of the government, the world fastest growing economy?
Yeah.
How do you explain it?
Definitely. They have opened their markets up considerably in the past, considering where they came from to where they are today. The markets have they've opened up a number of different ways. So I believe that's the key thing, and China is a perfect example, in this, when you're looking at economic freedoms. They have a long ways to go, and the political freedom definitely is not there, but they have opened it up, and there are, foreign corporations are allowed into China. There are, there are a number of corporations that are Chinese that are now in, North American markets, European markets, and that, trade liberalization has allowed them to grow, immensely. So.
Actually, Ty, there are a few more people lined up, so go ahead.
Okay, could we take a trip to Liberia?
Okay, I'm not familiar, but go ahead.
Yeah, and the Firestone there. Kids 7, 8, if they're lucky, they live to be 8 and 9. Because they are there working 17, 18 hours a day. Is that global justice? I think it is in your view, and you can perhaps explain why that is global justice. Or if it isn't global justice, what would you suggest you do about that?
Yeah, great question. Inevitably the question that comes up when you bring up, economic freedom, trade liberalization, is what about these, sweatshops and these, terrible conditions? What I would look at and say, look at their degrees of economic freedom. I'm sure I'm not familiar with Liberia, how free they are. in terms of, you know, are these children choosing, you know, are these people choosing?
The reason they're doing that is because the parents, in order to get money, have to work and you know,
I mean, definitely, I mean, that's where, I mean, I believe, you know, government needs to regulate those things. And that's where you need to have, you know, strong political freedoms so that, you know, you have, if you have a, you know, liberal democracies or, you know, countries that can, that do value the rights of people and can protect those rights. But for me, if people have economic freedoms, a lot of these times in these countries, the sweatshops, what we like to call them, are actually much better employment than they can have, you know, doing other things. You know, whether it's, you know, picking up plastic or finding metal chunks on a garbage dump, you know, those type of things. The sweatshop conditions are much better, and there's been a whole slew of studies that recently have come out that show that these sweatshops, on average, pay twice as much as the average wages in these countries. So a lot of times it is benefiting people, and these different, you know, these foreign corporations. Okay, and you know, in that case, you know, you need to have government leadership. I mean, that's key, right? You know, and that's where you can't have unrestrained capitalism, because, you know, people, you know, there are some bad corporations out there that will exploit workers to no end, and so you need to have government controls to make sure that they're not being, you know, completely exploited. Yeah.
My name is Tom, and I wanted to ask you about is there economic freedom and employment in the United States? So is that a country that you think is doing some good things? And do you think that if capitalism is doing so well there, the injustice should be not in a company that in a country that's such a fine gross domestic product at all? How do you compare Norway and the United States with the idea of just the convergence theory that education happened, social programs, pensions, and healthcare? Like, I was appalled that you said a couple of times in your talk that governments should hold business accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I was appalled when President Obama gave his speech, his State of the Union speech, that he is pleading with both of his houses in the United States, could we please tax a little bit some of the wealthy in our country so that the poor can eat and get education, and please don't defeat my health care for all the citizens who can't afford it. If we only tax a little bit, some of those wealthy could have so much and fully the rest. So he's the person that's supposed to hold the corporations accountable. He can't do it, and he's begging for his life to try to help the injustice in his own country, and I think that's a country that has been based on some freedom.
Yeah.
What about that? There's Norway.
I can't speak to Norway. I don't know a whole lot today. I will speak to the U.S. And, you know, I'm a fan of the U.S. system. I think the economic freedom that's afforded to people there is great. What I would, you know, like I said, what government needs to do is make sure that the market is open and to everyone, that everybody is able to participate in the market. So if, you know, if there's, you know, monopolies or, you know, there's like really, you know, certain sectors that are really hard to break into, the government needs to take measures to open those markets up.
Corporations stop the President of the United States from taking those measures you have nothing to do.
Right, and that's not economic freedom. That's one of the roles. And so I would, you know, in that case, if economic freedom is being subverted, then the, you know, the government needs to take.
In Norway, it's going to do this more, because last time you were here, we did start asking questions, you ran out of time, and we were starting to say Norway, we were able to look it up. In Norway, they tax the corporations, which President Obama was begging they do in the United States. So they tax the corporations. What they do with the money they gave it to education, the social programs, the pensions for seniors, and health care.
Okay.
And the companies are still making some money, like the previous speaker. The companies in Norway are still making good profits, but they're not making obscene profits, and the people, the injustice is not there in Norway.
Okay. Actually, last time you mentioned Sweden, that was the one that was mentioned to me, and I did. Okay. So I can't speak specifically to Norway, but I can speak to Sweden. I did do some research on there. Yeah. No. That's fine. And it sounds all great. You know, they're taxing these corporations, and they're giving all the money to poor. But I don't know if you've looked at them in the last few years. They have been in a serious financial position. A lot of their corporations have been leaving, going elsewhere, because the costs are just too high. The financial costs are, too oppressive, and so it's actually been detrimental to their population. And they're starting to privatize now. They're starting to cut corporate taxes and those things. So, it sounds great. It's a great fix, for short-term benefits. People love it, but, in the end, you need to create this economic freedom, which will, produce long-term economic benefits. So.
Thank you. Do you have any time for more questions? Thank you, Trevor.
You probably get all the and it's occurred directly after the military conflict over who the Democrats have the government and imposed a military dictatorship for the next few decades and murdered tens of thousands of people, or two others. The present seems like a non-force equation for economic freedom.
Right. Like I said, I'm a big fan of political freedoms too. I think they need to go hand in hand. The thing is, you can have economic freedoms without political freedoms. And, that does increase the wealth of the country, it reduces poverty, all these things. And, that's good. But, there's also the life. You have to look at, people's lives. And just because they're, have access, have more freedoms, their corporations can do business more easily, those type of things, and they're creating more wealth, doesn't necessarily mean that they're not being repressed, their rights are being repressed, right? And so that needs to be addressed too. What I'm saying though is that you can have economic freedoms without other freedoms, and that will produce, generate wealth, and reduce poverty.
Thank you, Rory.
Thanks.
All right, so we'll just give the judges a few minutes to finish tallying their scorecards.